Epiphany, another Greek word. Is it familiar to you? It's part of the English language, sort of. But Epiphany Sunday, is that part of St. Matthew's experience, or am I landing something new on you? Dom, Epiphany Sunday. Is that familiar? Okay, that's familiar. Thank you. Well, it's a Greek word, and it simply means the manifestation or the showing forth. So sometimes dramatic type people say, I've had an epiphany, which means I've seen something. Something's been revealed to me. It's come clear. So Epiphany Sunday, traditionally Three Kings Sunday, or Three Kings rather, always occurs on the 6th, so often during the week. I love it so much because it's part of the gospel. I take it to the next Sunday. And what it's about, what it refers to, is Israel's long-standing hope that the glory of God would be revealed to all nations. All flesh shall see. And that is Epiphany. That's the essence of it. And that through Israel, God would be revealed to the nations of the world. Now, this, we believe, has been realized in Jesus Christ. And that's what I'm going to be speaking on today and how it leads us to worship. So we heard in Isaiah this morning, Ross read this from Isaiah 60. It's a beautiful verse. Just anticipates so well the story of the Magi or the Three Kings. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Now, there are many flaws and failures in church history. I don't know if you have this experience, but you talk to people about the faith and someone will say, the Spanish Inquisition, or the Crusades, or colonialism here in New Zealand. Do you get that sort of feedback at times? Okay. There's a lot to lament, but it's a present fact of history that the faith of Israel, the people of the ancient Near East, has through Jesus Christ and his church been accepted by people of every nation and people group on earth. That is a big fat fact on the ground. That is Epiphany promised and realized. Possibly a few unreached tribes or people groups, but in today's world, that's fairly hard to maintain. Where talk goes, where trade goes, the gospel goes. And something of the glory of Jesus Christ is revealed and seen. Even when there are huge mechanisms to try and suppress that and stop that, as there are in many parts of the world. So the Gospel of Matthew points to the beginning of this, of God's glory being revealed through Jesus Christ to the nations, the Gentiles, with the visit of the pagan astrologers described as magi. It's related to the English word magic, which gives you a sense of the sort of guys they were. Think magician, wise man from the East, probably Persia. And we're not told how many there were. We've got three sort of seared on the brain, but that is just the deduction from the fact that there were three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. One per magi is the deduction, but the scripture doesn't actually say. So these Gentiles, pagans from the nations is a biblical way of saying not from Israel, they interpreted the stars to find humanity's new king come from heaven. That was their worldview. That was their way of thinking. Many parts of the world still look to the heavens. It's a curious part of the Christmas story that this worked out like this. God gets his message through in curious ways. Now, unless you're Jewish here this morning, a son or daughter of Abraham, these pagan seekers represent us. We are the nations. We are the goyim. Do you have any idea what your ancestors were worshipping 2,000 years ago? Chris, you're smiling. Maybe it was cricket. From archaeology, from what I've read from around the world, and as most of us here are pale-skinned, look to Northern Europe, it's not pretty. Sticks, stones, and some pretty mean practices, so the bone record shows us. But even today, not far from here, there are people worshipping sticks and stones. That's a long way from the glory of God. The pagans, the goyim. So the story of the first realization of Epiphany is surprising. These pagan astrologers, they may have had a poor worldview. Their cosmology may have been not up to NASA standards. They had bad theology. But what I want to focus on this morning and commend them for is they understood worship. They demonstrate and model something fantastic. So for about 1800 years in my telling, that's basically the Old Testament, the Hebrews, the historical bit of the Old Testament, the Hebrews and then the people of Israel had been learning two fundamental lessons. Who the one true God is, and how do you worship this one true God? Could I have the next slide, please? Now, learning this, who the one true God is, and how you worship the one true God, was a very bumpy process. There was often one step forward and two steps back, and it was not a smooth progression. And there were confusions and distortions and worse. Now, the key difficulty, the key challenge is this. The one true God, or Yahweh, is not like other gods. Not like other gods. And the word to designate this is he's holy. Holy means other. Beyond our categories. Don't reduce him into a pattern that's familiar or comfortable for you. He's not like what the neighbors worship. Now, I grew up in the suburbs, and more so in Christchurch because it's fairly flat, and we all have a 1.8 meter, 6 foot fence. Now, looking over to see what the neighbors are doing, it's part of life, isn't it? What are the neighbors doing? How do they do this? And it can be something as mundane as putting the rubbish out, or their gardening, or barbecuing, or whatever. That's what people do. But in these questions, what is God like, and how do you worship him? No. We are relating to a God, one who is completely different from what the neighbors are into. So almost we needed not 6 foot fences, we needed much higher fences. We needed concrete sunglasses or blinkers. Don't do what the neighbors do. And that runs right through what it is to be a follower and worshiper of the one true God. There's always this discipline and this tension. Ignore the neighbors. Because we are about something that is holy, and we are seeking to worship the holy God as is appropriate. Okay, so there's two lessons. Who is the one true God, and how do you worship him? Incidentally, that question, who is the one true God, doesn't have much traction in the West. But you go east, and it's alive and kicking. Because there are many gods. And the fact, the expectation that the gods are there or God is there is obvious. We're a step behind that now. So, next screen, please. So, two points of consideration for worship. Now, to understand worship, there's something about the horse and the cart relationship here we need to get clear. Worship is determined by the object of worship. In other words, the worship you bring something, someone, some situation is set up by who or what you are worshiping. Otherwise, it ain't worship. It's shaped by that who question. Who is God determines how God is to be worshipped. Now, the Anglo-Saxon word worship is very helpful here, very helpful. I love going back to the roots of words and having a few languages under my belt. It's you get into the logic of the language. Now, worship is Germanic, and it basically comes from the idea of you give the worth. That's what worship is. You give the worth. You are recognizing, acknowledging, honoring the worth of something or someone. And it captures this principle beautifully. It's the object of our worship that determines the worship, not the subject, not the one offering it, deciding for themselves. And that's what Israel had to learn again and again and again. And it's so tempting. Well, the neighbors do it this way. No, 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 no. Don't look at the neighbors. Look at the one you're worshiping. Okay. So the logic builds. A holy God requires and deserves holy worship. It's getting intense and it's getting complicated now. Okay. So worship is giving due worth as determined by the one you're worshiping, or in our case, the value of God and Jesus Christ. So one of the implications of this is that worship is not about us. It's not about us. Now, in churchy land, there's a question that's often asked. How was the worship this morning? Now, it's a daft question. It's a daft question. And it betrays some stinking thinking. Who is the one to gauge how the worship was this morning? It's God. And unless you get some feedback from the Lord, hey, I like this, or no, just like Amos, take away from me the cacophony of your music. I've had a gutsful of it. But I don't want to hear any more of us. Unless you get some sort of feedback, you really don't know. But where we go, how was the worship this morning? Oh, it was great. You know, the music rolled and this happened and we were in tune and it was great. What that's actually saying is, as a participant, I enjoyed it. Which is okay. That's something to be aware of, but it's not actually an assessment of the worship. Secondly, so what was I saying there? Yes, worship is for God, not for us. Secondly, the Holy God of Israel, known as Yahweh, made it clear time and time again that worship needs to be personally authentic and genuine. It's personal. You've got to be real. The story of Cain and Abel in Genesis speaks to this. You know the story. Josiah, do you know the story of Cain and Abel? Ooh, little guy looks like a rabbit caught in the headlight. Okay, it's growing on him. I don't mean to scare you. So Cain made his offering from the harvest of his field, but he was not personally invested, was he? Here's a sack of, you know, of grain. Be happy with it. Now bless me. He was only going through the motions, and so his attempt at worship was rejected because he wasn't personally invested. Now, the shorthand for this is we are the worship. When you come to honor God, to recognize his worth, you do it by bringing yourself. Now it's really personal, isn't it? It's not about getting it right or following some formula or something being achieved through correct words or ritual. It's not, as the medieval church called it, ex opere operato. Just by virtue of doing it, you've done it. It's good. Use the right words, the right people did it, therefore the Almighty will be delighted. No. So Jesus echoed this need for genuine worship in one conversation with the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, when he said in John 4, "But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him." God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. So if you ain't in it, it ain't worship. If you ain't in it, it ain't worship. So until Jesus had said this, the conversation with the woman at the well had been about where people should worship. Very important to get the mountain right. When I preached this in the Netherlands, it was always a bit of a joke. They had no topography to speak of. But having been to Gerizim and having been to Mount Zion, yeah, the mountain matters. And so that was what they argued about. And Jesus thought like a Dutchman and said, no, it doesn't matter about mountains at all. It's about spirit and truth. Are you actually in it? And you know what he eventually said about the temple in Jerusalem? That stone by stone it would come down and he would replace it. So, those are a few comments about worship. And what it calls from us. Now let's go back to the Magi, these pagan guys from East. Incidentally, when I say guys, it's a pun. And it's a bit not done to unpack a pun, but this is a good one. A lot of our language comes from America. When Europeans went to America, words got sort of turned around. Well, the Yiddish term goyim means the Gentiles, the nations. And in New York, the goyim became goy, guys. So when we say casually, hey guys, we're actually using a Yiddish word that's been Americanized and come back to us with a completely different meaning. Language is fun. So the Magi, these guys from the East, saw in Jesus a king sent from heaven. The signs were there, the markers were there. This looked right. So they came to acknowledge and give him his worth. His worth. So what was their worship? They traveled, which took time and energy. They gave him their attention, even their devotion. Now, attention is precious stuff. I am so aware, as one who speaks to a microphone and a camera these days, the attention span is holy ground. You've got to treat it well. And where we put our attention is an indication of our worship. They bent the knee. They bent the knee. They made themselves small to magnify the one that they were honoring. And they reverenced him, presenting their homage with costly gifts. They gave stuff, bits of themselves, bits of their lives, represented by gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So their theology may not have been biblical, but their practice of worship was great. So what might that mean for us today? Well, this event is set up as an opportunity, today, where we are in this event, which is set up as an opportunity to worship God together as revealed in Jesus Christ. We're only 2 weeks after Christmas, after all. So next screen, please. So the same issues that faced Israel face us. Who is God? And what is his character and his heart? Who is God? What's he like? Everyone tends to have some sense of what God is like, even if it's the God they don't believe in. I mean, it can happen quite often. People are telling you about, I don't believe in God, da, 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 da. And one way to engage that is to say, well, tell me about this God you don't believe in. And they'll give a whole lot of reasons why they are disappointed or angry or the image of God they don't like. And you can say back, well, I don't believe in that God either. Okay. See, what is God like is so important. Just those three letters, G-O-D in English, they need unpacking. And secondly, how should we respond to his worth now in worship? How do you do that? They're live questions all the time. So currently, what's put on offer here and what you walk into from the time you hear Kathy ringing the church chimes through to the end of the service, what are some of the things we actually do? Well, we turn up. You get 10 marks for turning up. Tick. We offer set prayers of confession, praise, and adoration because we're part of a tradition. Goes right back to the prayer book of Israel and the Psalms. We sing prayers of praise, of thanksgiving, and worship. We make offerings, and typically in money, cash or digital. We sign and seal our faith and hope in Christ through Holy Communion, which is where we're going today. I mean, these are all things we do that are a corporate way of trying to honor the worth of God as revealed in Jesus Christ. Now, these things in and of themselves are not spirit and truth. They're not worship in themselves. They're like platforms. They're like vehicles. They're activities that enable us to do this together. But the essence is a bit deeper. It's about giving ourselves. Because God is worth nothing less. And giving ourselves in spirit and truth. They are forms of worship. One of the scariest verses, and I don't know the exact chapter and verse, someone may know this. I think it's from Thessalonians, where Paul says, avoid people who know the forms of religion, but not its power. Avoid people who know the forms of religion, but not its power. Who's heard of love languages? Two hands went up. Love languages. Okay, time's limited, so please, for your interest, Google it afterwards. It's been around for a couple of decades. Very accessible sort of book. Is it Chapman? So basically the insight is people have different ways of showing their love. And unless we understand that, we are going to be constantly frustrated and disappointed with others. So, five ways of showing love: time, touch, talk, service, or gifts. Time, touch, talk, service, or gifts. So to give a classic little illustration of how this gets makes sense of life, some of my family members are hugely into gifts. It's my weakest love language. I'm just not wired that way. It's stuff. So I'm a time, touch, talk person. If you want to love me, give me time. Touch me. Talk to me. And if I'm bringing that to you, guess what? That's my love. That's how I bring it. And I think this sort of understanding of how we actually bring our love relates to our worship. So time, touch, talk, service, and gifts, they're all appreciated, but they're not the love itself. That's something deeper. They manifest the love and they enable it to be given and received. We need some sort of understanding about worship like that too. Paul writes to the Romans, present yourselves as living sacrifices. Now he's sort of taking this image of sacrificial worship. Imagine that table was an altar. And instead of putting a sheep or a bird or something there as your offering, you put yourself there. That's what he's suggesting. Not in concrete terms, but as the focus of our worship. So, what's our way forward? Next image, please. It's Epiphany Sunday. The answer to every question is Jesus. And the Epiphany answer is Jesus in two dimensions. Firstly, in terms of revelation, in terms of showing forth, Jesus shows us what God is like. That question, what is God like? The answer, Jesus. Any answer to that question which does not reference Jesus is not Christian. It's that simple. Jesus shows us what God is like. He is the very imprint of the invisible God, we read in Colossians 1:15 and following. In human form, a form that we can understand. Is anyone here not human? I thought so. We get what it is to be human. And secondly, he shows us, he manifests, he provides an epiphany of how humans are to relate to God and each other in God's kingdom, in God's household, God's economy, God's regime or administration. And that's what Epiphany is all about. The fact that God has shown, manifested himself to all peoples in Jesus Christ. So what we need to do is to bring this to every issue, every question, every aspect of life. Everything must have a Jesus answer. Because the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, so he could be seen. And we are to present ourselves to him who laid himself down for us. So how do you get into this? Well, it's very simple. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The go-to books. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Where else do you meet Jesus? And so, if we take God's revelation, God's epiphany to heart, that's where we go. And in a good week, we go there every day. We go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John every day. You might only go for a few verses, but you go there to meet Jesus. You go there to see the one set forth as the very image of the invisible God. And everything you see, you say to yourself, this is what God is like. Whatever the neighbors say, this is what God is like. Whatever Hollywood says, this is what God is like. And this, in Jesus, is how God is worshipped. And this is how you relate to other people. We bring Jesus into everything. A church that does that will be a Jesus church. But the temptation is always so strong to do what the neighbors do. And the way it seems to work in the modern world is this. We typically go to school and we have professional training and we have worldly experience. And that quickly gets brought to bear on things at the cost of asking, well, what did Jesus do? What would Jesus say? And our worship loses traction. So, Epiphany. God's glory being revealed through his people, supremely in Jesus Christ, to the nations, to all the peoples. And it's a big part of the gospel. And it's a part of the gospel that we can dig into and live every day.